Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we hear a lot about mental health these days. It's prominent in the arguments about gun violence. Whether restricting access to certain types of weapons or improving access to mental health treatment, or at least records, should have the higher priority. And it's an issue in the discussion of the social distancing and quarantines associated with the coronavirus pandemic and the mental health problems that they could cause, right? And you can tell just from the number of ads on TV for drugs to treat depression and bipolar disorder and so on, how common it is. In my extended family, several years back, we had a long and agonizing encounter with mental illness that threw the whole family into turmoil for a while. In trying to help deal with the situation, I became aware of how broken, actually almost non-existent, the mental health system in this country has become. So I've wanted for a long time to do a show on that topic, but to be honest, I really hadn't made a real effort to find the right person. But recently, I was first approached about doing a show based on an upcoming PBS documentary called The Definition of Insanity, which explores the work of the Miami-Dade Criminal Mental Health Project in Florida, which is an innovative approach for helping to solve the mental health crisis. And this project works through the court system to steer people with mental illness on a path from incarceration out to recovery. And I thought it was an important story, but it only dealt with one aspect of the issue, which is the mostly indigent people who end up being jailed and the harsh treatment they're often subjected to. And I wanted to deal with the topic more broadly, covering the impacts on patients and families across the whole socioeconomic spectrum and the economic and legal and social aspects of it. The producers of the film understood, and they led me to my guest on today's show. Norman Ornstein is a political scientist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative but nonpartisan public policy think tank in Washington, D.C. You might have seen him on TV news shows where he's a frequent commentator. Welcome, Norm.
It's great to be with you, Court.
Thanks so much for being on. So you're an expert on Congress and the political system, and one might ask how you acquired an interest in the topic of mental illness and treatment. I know how, and it's the same way that many people, including me, suddenly take an intense interest in the subject, but if you don't mind, please tell our listeners your story.
So I have a son, Matthew, who was a brilliant young man, was a national champion high school debater, went to Princeton and excelled, was out in Hollywood doing quite well with a TV show that he had co-created. And at age 24, he had a psychotic break. We don't know what the cause was. This is something that often happens with young people from the ages of 17 to about 25 or 26 when the prefrontal cortex of the brain is developing. We went through with him a 10-year struggle with serious mental illness. He believed that God had come for him and had not taken his body but had taken his soul, and didn't know why and was struggling to figure it out. And part of his brain disease, and I actually prefer the term brain disease to mental illness because it's a disease of an organ just as other organs. We sometimes think of what he had as stage 4 brain disease. Part of it was a phenomenon known as anosognosia, an unwieldy word that means that you have no insight into your illness. He didn't believe he was ill. He wouldn't take medication or get treatment. The system is so broken that we had no options to be able to require some kind of treatment. And after 10 years of enormous pain and frustration for us, which were much greater for him, he died accidentally of carbon monoxide poisoning in a motel room, really driven by the lack of judgment that he had stemming from his mental illness. And we were, of course, as any parent would be, devastated. 5 years later, he died at the age of 34. 5 years later, the pain is just as intense. But we created a foundation in his memory to try to do something to take grief and turn it to purpose to help others and other families from having to go through what we went through. And while he really never had serious encounters with the criminal justice system, getting to your larger point, the fact is, a large number of those who do have mental illness, and especially those with anosognosia, end up homeless on the streets or caught up in the criminal justice system and in jail or prison and treated horribly. And this documentary, The Definition of Insanity, shows a way in which you can both save lives and save money. And we decided that this was a good way to get the word out and then to take it around the country, something we can't do now because of the pandemic, but will ultimately to different communities to try to spread the word about best practices.
That's horrible. I'm so sorry.
So many go through this. And you're absolutely right, Court. You know, this was not an area of my expertise. I've learned an awful lot. I learned a lot through experience, 10 years of dealing with it. And I've gotten engaged in the public policy process. I worked with Congress to get what finally became the 21st Century's Cures Act, the first comprehensive look at some of these issues, incomplete and inadequate, but still a significant step forward. But so many of the people I've encountered along the way, the influential activists in the area of trying to change policy towards mental illness and those who have a serious mental illness especially, are those who had it hit them right between the eyes with members of their own families.
Well, I guess the silver lining is obviously that you're in a position to bring some greater good out of that nightmare, so thank you for that. Well, Norm, do we have any way of knowing how many mentally ill people there are in the U.S.?
There have been attempts to, you know, find absolute numbers. It's hard, and it's hard in part because mental illness or brain diseases cover so many different areas. You go from ADHD to anorexia to depression and anxiety, and all the way through to those on the spectrum that are considered to be serious mental illnesses, which includes things like bipolar disorder, schizoid affective, schizophrenia, and so on. What we know is, at least, it's hard to find a family that hasn't been affected by this, and that the numbers we're talking about are probably something like, overall, 1 in 8 Americans. What we also know is that something on the order of 40% of those in jails and prisons have a mental illness, 25% with a serious mental illness, and that close to a majority of those who are homeless are people with a serious mental illness.
Yeah, that's really something. Those statistics are just stunning.
One thing I'll say, Court, is, as you know, several months after Matthew passed, I wrote a piece in the New York Times. It was a wrenching thing to do, but it was because this 21st Century's Cures Act was foundering in Congress, and I got asked by some members of Congress to try and help them push it along. And I got flooded with responses. The article went viral. It was so stunning to me that the emails that I got, the phone calls that I got, almost invariably started with, "I've never told anybody this, but," and it was, "I've never told anybody this, but my father, my mother died of suicide, my child, my nephew," or, "I have a child who's going through something similar to what your son went through." What became clear to me is one reason we are not able to come up with very good statistics on how many people in the country suffer is because the stigma is still so great. You know, you don't hesitate to tell people, "I've got cancer," or "my sister has breast cancer," but you do when it comes to somebody having a mental illness.
Yeah, it's odd that there's always been sort of a cultural taboo against it. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Norm Ornstein, who is a political scientist and a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and has told us about a personal situation in his family that was, just long-running and horrifying, that went on, that ended in the death of his son. Let's talk, Norm, just to back up and talk briefly about the history of the treatment and or the system, which is really what the subject of this show is about. It's the mental illness system and the breakdown of not the breakdown of mental health, but the breakdown of the system that purports to deal with it, right? So 50 or more years ago in this country, there were state institutions for the mentally ill who couldn't afford private hospital care, which was the great majority of people. And they went by different names, but were generally grim, scary places that, you know, you tried not to think about. They were these big Soviet-era-looking buildings and something, but they were themselves a big improvement over the brutal, quote, lunatic asylums of a century earlier, where really people were kept in chains in what amounted to dungeons. I mean, you know, just these horrible, nightmarish situations, but probably conditions in them, in the state institutions, that is, still ranged from humane to inhumane. I mean, I would say that those listeners who've seen the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest will have an idea what I'm talking about. And even in these kind of more modern clinical sterile settings, they often featured electroshock treatment and straitjackets and even lobotomy for a long period of time. But beginning in the 1950s, there was a movement toward deinstitutionalization, a long word there, where it was argued that community services would be cheaper. And that kind of dovetailed with the rise of psychiatry and the belief that new psychiatric drugs made it more feasible to release people into the community. So the problem is that many of these people had and still have no place to go and no support for becoming able to join society and care for them is often left to their families, who may or may not have the resources, financial and otherwise, or even the willingness to provide that care. So as you said earlier, they often end up homeless on the streets, and that leads to the only form of institutionalization that's left is jail. So that's the subject of the film I mentioned, and you talked a little bit about, you know, how many prisoners are mentally ill and so on. I think 2 million people with mental illnesses are arrested every year and much more likely to wind up in jail than in a hospital. So why has the Miami-Dade program that I mentioned at the outset been so successful?
First of all, your larger point is absolutely spot on. There's another filming on public television called Bedlam, which is the name of one of the hospitals in Britain that was a sort of originator of this kind of treatment, and it's where the word Bedlam comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know that the well-meaning action that President Kennedy took shortly before he was assassinated to deinstitutionalize people, built in part because of his own horror at what had happened to his sister Rosemary, who had a lobotomy, which was a brutal operation that destroyed what remained of her life. And she was for decades in a horrible situation.
Mm-hmm.
But we never funded the community mental health centers, and that led to the homelessness and all of that, and has led to the jails. Right now, the three largest facilities for people with serious mental illness in the country are the L.A. County Jail, Cook County Jail in Chicago, and Rikers Island, which not long from now is going to be closed and will create another horror story. And people who are in the jails and prisons are often put in solitary, which is the worst thing you can do for somebody with a mental illness. They are not given any treatment. They're often mistreated by the guards. What Judge Lifman, Steve Lifman in Miami-Dade County, Florida, over 20 years has been able to do is simply transform this system and get a partnership with the county jail people who really don't want to be doing this, and it's costly to them, with the police, with the other judges, the prosecutors, and the public defenders who are normally at odds with one another. And there are two components to the program. One, which is a really important part of this, he has now trained over 7,500 police officers in this huge county, the seventh most populous in America, 36 separate entities within Miami-Dade County, in what's called Crisis Intervention Team Policing, a program originally developed in Memphis, Tennessee. It's a week-long intensive program, and police are taught to identify people who have a mental illness and to de-escalate the conflict instead of doing what they would normally do, which is you encounter somebody, you issue a command. If the command isn't obeyed, you escalate. And it's the worst kind of thing you can do for somebody who has a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually results in bad things. So over the years in which he's done this, they've reduced the number of shootings and encounters between police officers and those with mental illnesses from an average of 2 a month to now 5 or 6 in the last 10 years. And they've saved millions and millions in wrongful death suits. They've been able to cut the number of arrests in half, and as a consequence, close one of the three county jails and saved over the last 6 years $12 million a year.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, if you're not shot or tased, you're arrested for resisting arrest or for something else and thrown in jail. And by doing this, they've saved money and they've saved lives. And it's been a huge thing. And I would add, Court, one interesting little side benefit. They're now getting 250 calls a month into their mental health hotline from police officers who, you know, for a long time, so many of them, many are veterans. They're in difficult crisis situations every single day, PTSD, depression, and other issues. The suicide rate among police officers is sky high. You're not going to mention it to anybody. It's a sign of weakness, or if they know about it in the precinct, they might take you off the beat and put you in a desk job. Now they recognize that this is a brain disease that hits so many, and they're getting treatment for it. The core part of the program, though, and this is key, is a comprehensive diversion program. If you come into the criminal justice system in Miami-Dade County, and it can be a nonviolent felony or a misdemeanor, and they see that you have a history of mental illness, or they test and they see it, You're given a choice of going to trial or going into this program where they find you a place to live, and then they give you wraparound services with a mental health professional, a social worker, a peer counselor. You get an individualized treatment program, and every month you come back to the court. And if after a year you've complied with the program, they expunge your record, and you, for many of them, they're stabilized and they're able to lead productive lives. And that's great for the community. It gets homeless people off the streets. They're not cycling through the system. It saves them money, and you're giving people back their lives. And it's had a miraculous impact. Of course, it doesn't work for everybody, but it works for a large number of them. And it's really been an enormous success in that community. It's very different, by the way, in other parts of Florida that haven't adopted this program, much less around the country. And our film demonstrates pretty compellingly how this works and looks at people whose lives have been transformed by it.
Wow, well, that's a 180-degree shift away from the normal scenario you describe. In fact, I'll say I have a colleague whose son, really in the same pattern you described, became schizophrenic suddenly in college and then ended up not that long ago being shot to death by police because he didn't respond as expected to commands and in fact became more agitated when they burst into his car and was to them resisting arrest, and they shot him to death. And you know, it could have been avoided entirely if the police had known how to handle that. So the kind of thing you're talking about, is this kind of program been transposed anywhere else in the country yet?
We're starting to see some places, Detroit, Cuyahoga County, and Cleveland, are picking up on some elements of it. One of the things I want to stress is there are places that have mental health courts. It's not the same thing. And you have judges who don't understand some of the dynamics of mental illness. The diversion program and the full range of treatments is not used in a lot of places, but people are starting to wake up, and we're going to try and get more of them to wake up.
That sounds good, and I hope it metastasizes further pretty soon because it sounds like a great alternative to the current non-system. Well, let's talk briefly about something in Florida called the Baker Act, which really is 72 hours of involuntary institutionalization for those considered to be a danger to themselves or others, and they can be turned in by family members or friends or other people for judgment as to whether they fall under the Baker Act and can be put into a facility for 3 days. But it becomes a revolving door. I mean, in 3 days, nobody's going to be cured, right? So they come back out after one or two interviews with a psychiatrist who's looking at his watch and in a hurry most of the time. And many people, as you described, I mean, a lot of people with paranoid delusions act normally, except that they have a particular bee in their bonnet that's fully insane. But they pick up pretty quickly that if they act a certain way, they can get out the door. And they know how to do that. And so they just pretend that they're fine. And then they're sent on their way. And maybe 4 days later, they're Baker acted again. You know, so this becomes, as I say, a revolving door. But it's no kind of solution at all. Are there similar laws to that in every state? And I think that happened to your son, actually, right?
Yeah, one of the most painful things that occurred with us was at one point our son was living in a condominium near Sarasota, Florida that we had, and the people who ran it, there were a lot of rentals there, didn't like the fact that our son, who kept very odd hours, who smoked heavily, so many people with serious mental illness smoke because there's something in the nicotine that, you know, works to ease some of the difficulties in their brains, had long hair and a beard, and got in touch with us and said, this is very dangerous, he's a danger to himself. We went down to Florida and used the Baker Act. It was basically just a ruse to get him out of there, but our poor son was in this unit, actually was just showering. He was going to go on a Friday evening to religious services, and he got out of the shower, and there were three police officers and a couple of others who wouldn't even let him get dressed, cuffed him, and took him off to a mental health facility, and 72 hours later, deeply traumatized with nothing done to help because they couldn't even force medication, he was let go, and it made it worse. Now, there are instances where you really do want to have somebody who needs hospitalization to be hospitalized. But as you said, 72 hours doesn't do anything for you. And the standard that's used in most states, and most states don't have a program just like this, but the typical standard is you have to be an imminent danger to yourself or others. And imminent means almost literally a gun to your head or a knife to someone's throat. And once you are not in that condition, you get released back out again. So we need adjustments. They've done a few on the Baker Act. Judge Leifman has been very much involved with that. But we need a different set of standards, and we need to have the ability, including with assisted outpatient treatment, where you're not keeping people locked up, but you're providing some level of treatment akin to what we see with Judge Leifman's program, for people who don't recognize that they're ill, who have no insight and no ability to understand the circumstances they're in. There's an effort underway to do this, but most states are way behind.
Yeah, so for the people who are not on track to go to jail, the cost of reasonably decent treatment facilities that might have some chance of actually helping the person are enormous. I mean, in the case that I was aware of personally, it was at least $1,500 to $2,000 a day. I mean, how many people can afford that kind of 7 days a week payment, right? I mean, that's going to drain anybody's financial resources really in a hurry. And so do we have any way of knowing how much the treatment of mental illness costs in this country each year?
It is into the many hundreds of billions of dollars, and especially if you consider the costs in the jails and prisons as a part of what the society is paying for the treatment of those with mental illness. It's an enormous burden. And of course, it's a burden where, despite the fact that we now have built into our health insurance system parity, mental health parity, most insurance companies are not willing to pay some of those costs. But because they're not paying them, people get worse, and then the cost to society becomes that much greater. So a realignment here, an understanding that we can do this with an initial expenditure of some money, but in a way that will save the system and the country a lot more, is what's necessary. But we're throwing a lot of money down the drain. Now, one thing I'll say on that front, when Judge Leifman really began to do this, and by the way, what motivated him was a very early case. A young man who had was Harvard educated with a degree from Harvard Medical School, had been the chief resident in psychiatry at Jackson Memorial Hospital and had a psychotic break, homeless. And Judge Leifman, who saw that he was floridly psychotic, tried to get him treatment, did the 72 hours, and then was told, as he got a civil liberties lawyer, this young man, that county judges didn't have the authority to hospitalize him for any longer. And 20 years after he was released onto the streets, his family, nobody knows whether he's dead or alive. We've got a big problem on that front. What he discovered as he did this deep dive was there were 97 people in Miami who were chronically homeless, almost all schizophrenic. They were cycling in and out of the system. They'd languish in front of stores and office buildings, be picked up by the police, thrown into jail for a couple of months, mostly in solitary, then just thrown back out onto the streets. And they were costing the county $13 to $14 million over 5 years to get nothing for it. So changing the system means that you're going to stop throwing money down a rat hole.
You know, so I'm thinking also of another movie, The Graduate from long, long ago, and the Simon and Garfunkel song, Mrs. Robinson. And so one of the lines is, stroll around the grounds until you feel at home. So that's a kind of country club facility that costs an enormous amount and only the most wealthy people can afford. But is there anything between jail and that really now? Are there community health services centers that are some kind of rudimentary replacement for the state mental institutions that used to be fairly ubiquitous?
So we have 5% of the beds that existed before the creation of the so-called community mental health centers at the end of the Kennedy presidency. And the reality at this point, and you've hit on a very important point, is we have a two-tiered system. One is we have the more posh facilities that people with significant means can use, but only for those who are willing to try and get some treatment. Then there are the jails and the prisons. One of the insane elements of the law that we have is that the community mental health centers, if you have more than 16 beds devoted to mental health, you do not get Medicaid funding. So there's no incentive to have those beds for people who are in crisis situations. And these community mental health centers, right now in the midst of the pandemic, many of them are closed. They people who are working there don't want to go in because they don't have the protective gear. And that means that people who have relied on them, even if they're not using the beds to go in and get their meds or to get some counseling, have been left out of it. Judge Leifman got a call just last week from somebody saying, we have a homeless person who's positive for COVID-19, who has no awareness of his own mental illness, much less of what this disease means, can we have this person put in a facility where the treatment can occur? And the answer is, yes, you can use the Baker Act now because this person is an imminent danger to himself or others. Whether you can force medication or keep them for any length of time is still uncertain. And for a lot of them in states that don't have even a Baker Act, you know, we're leaving people vulnerable, but also vulnerable to getting others. And now we're starting to see this problem hit the prisons where they don't have any kind of social distancing or protection. And it's a call to action on a larger front to deal with all of these issues together, criminal justice reform and reform of the mental illness system.
Norm, this is such a big topic, and we could easily talk another half hour about it, but we are getting toward the end of the show. And I want to mention one other important aspect of this whole picture that complicates things considerably, and that's the HIPAA Act, which stands for the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It sounds so benignly bureaucratic. It's a federal law that protects the privacy of individual health information, which is a good thing in principle. It also protects mental health treatment records, and that means in practice that unless the patient gives other people access to their records, and often they don't because they don't think that they're mentally ill, or they think that people are trying to set up a case that they're mentally ill, or you know, that kind of thing. So often they don't give access to even their spouses to have them access to their records. And that means that mental health practitioners are not allowed to provide any information to family members about their condition or their treatment or the prognosis or even where they are. I mean, all they can do is pay these bills, write these big checks. I'm sure you would agree that that is a giant hole in the floor that prevents, it's a barrier to a lot of progress being made. And I don't know what the solution is. Do you have a 30-second answer as to what the solution to that problem might be?
We encountered this, and it was deeply frustrating. At one point, Matthew was in a hospital. We knew he was there. They wouldn't even tell us that whether he was in the hospital. And sometimes they used HIPAA as a shield. But there are reforms that can be done so that information can be shared with family members. And it's vital that this happen. And by the way, it's not just family members. I've talked to many university presidents who, because of the shield of HIPAA, can't even inform parents or know in many instances when some of their students have serious mental illness problems or mental health issues. And that sometimes leads to suicide. It's preventable if we make some tweaks in this HIPAA law, and that's really an important part of it.
You're a political scientist. You're deep into the workings of our political system. What's the outlook for this politically? Is it another issue that falls into the partisan divide in Congress between Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives?
It hasn't been so much a partisan issue, and the 21st Century Cures Act passed overwhelmingly in the House and Senate. But getting the funding for it does become a problem, and that does tend to divide people along partisan lines. The solution, I'm afraid, is going to end up being in local communities, being able to pick up on best practices and doing things where we're going to get less action from the feds. But we do need action from the feds in areas like HIPAA.
Norm, we have to end it there. And I do want to say that the movie we talked about, the documentary called The Definition of Insanity, premiered back in April and is still viewable on PBS.org. Just look up, go to PBS.org/The Definition of Insanity, and you can watch the film for free. Norman Ornstein, I want to thank you so much for being on with us to talk about this painful subject and painful to you and your family, especially personally. Appreciate it.
I appreciate being able to talk with you, Court. Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.